House Committee on Judiciary, Subcommittee 1, June 5th, 1985, public hearing. Bills to be considered are House Bill 2648, under public hearing and possible work session, Senate Bills 451, 400, House Bills 3030, 24, 29, 30, 06, Senate Bill 861, Senate Bill 259, House Bill 3022, Senate Bill 148.
Ron will come to order, please. We have got a busy afternoon. We have been excused, subject to call by the speaker, because the session is scheduled at 4. Senator Brown is here to speak with us on Senate Bill 451. I want to note that before I ask Senator Brown to proceed and thank him for his patience, 3022, which is relating to prohibition of dispersing funds to religious institutions, has been set over until tomorrow at the request of individuals who have a conflict with their schedule and had to return to Portland and wanted very much to speak to amendments which have been proposed as a result of conversations with the proponents, the ACLU, the Attorney General's Office, and others. And members have before them a letter sent to Representative Favish by Deputy Attorney General Bill Geary and amendments attached. So please review that before tomorrow. Senator Brown, Senate Bill 451.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I've just given to Representative Peterson a copy of Senate Bill 731, which was introduced in the 1983 session. And if you look at that bill, you'll see that that was introduced at the request of the Oregon Council of Police Association, the United Seniors, and the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and the Oregon Peace Officers Association, and the State Sheriff's Association, the Grain and the Farmers Union, and the Residential Care Facility. They all were concerned with this sort of problem. This year, the AARP identified this legislation as one of their top five, and they did that on their own motion without any encouragement from me, and then came to me and said, well, we take another run at this particular bill. Let me say, the bill passed the Senate last session, and when it got over to the House, it came to this committee, in fact. When the bill came to this committee, there were two separate items that were stuffed into it. One was for the district attorneys dealing with merger and concurrent sentences. I've got the letter dated July the 6th, 1983 from the Oregon District Attorneys Association, in which they asked to add their bill to the senior citizen assault bill, and the Hispanic Political Action Committee, President Daniel Santos, asked to put on the bill some legislation concerning the enforcement of federal immigration law by local, county, and state police. And so with the baggage that added to the bill when it came back to the Senate, it failed on a concurrence motion to support House amendments. What I've given to you is just pulled out of my file a copy of the AARP's priority listing this matter, a letter from the United Seniors. You may well have received that. Let me say that my files are filled with clippings showing how particularly older women and particularly street crimes suffer through the years. What is a fairly innocuous mugging turns out to be a broken hip and a death sentence to a senior. There's one, it's kind of at home here in Salem, a little woman, 78, gets to church a little early, goes around the block and never makes it, is mugged on the street, robbed of $5. And fortunately, she survived, others don't. I'm giving you a clipping I found in the Oregonian back in 1980. There was a conference of seniors in Massachusetts, and they urged legislation which was finally adopted protecting those of 65 years and older. About 1980, this particular problem kind of so-called hit the fan, and you'll notice that attached to these materials I've given you is a page from the a source book of American state legislation, 1980, in which a Senior Citizen Protection Act was proposed, and the thrust of the textual material indicates that seniors are the most frequent victims of certain types of crime, the purse snatching and the mugging on the street. It falls into that category. It's very difficult to find statistics as to the extent to which seniors are subject to a crime, but in the mid-1970s, the U.S. Department of Justice did studies in 8 cities and showed that seniors in the Portland area had a doubling of victimization on aggravated assault, and senior women had a tripling of susceptibility to rape. Now, there has been some concern as to whether we're singling out seniors, why not pregnant women and hemophiliacs and small children, and maybe legislators from this sort of thing. I've just Xeroxed off here a page from American Jurisprudence showing that traditionally around the country there have been assault statutes which do provide for enhanced penalties or specific aspects of aggravation, and the sex and age of the victim is not an untypical way of going. In fact, recently the Central District Committee was struggling with whether or not pornography protection for juveniles should be cut off at age 15 or extended to the 16 and 17 year olders, and the bill that comes over to you from the Senate is going to cut it off at age 15. I was one of 4 who argued we should extend it to 16 years old and 17 year olders. But age is clearly present in many statutes around the country. I've given you a Texas statute where the assault under Texas law is aggravated if an adult male commits an offense upon an adult female, and there was a question of equal protection, and the court had no problem indicating on the second page that it's a matter of common knowledge that women are smaller physical stature and strength than men. They haven't looked at mortality tables, however, and notice that the injuries are more serious, and this is true, and the analogy is argument certainly can be made for seniors. And it's a kind of an old and honorable tradition that we do provide that sort of protection. I just took a fast look a couple years ago at English law. Here's a page out of Harris's criminal law showing that as of 1861, English law for ordinary assaults provided for a $50 fine and a 50-pound fine and 2 months imprisonment. But if the victim were a child under 14 or a female, those penalties, fine was doubled and the imprisonment was tripled. I don't want to add anything more. I might say there would be seniors here today, Bill Perrin and others, to the best of my belief, thought the hearing was going to be tomorrow, so they were here this morning and left. And I fortunately read my materials a little closer, and I'm glad to have this opportunity to testify. The bill came out of Senate Judiciary. We had 6 out of 9 members were sponsors. It came out with 7 out of 9 to pass, and all 9 of our Senate Judiciary members voted for the bill on the floor. I think there were 4 abstaining votes on the floor in the Senate. Now you might say, well, this doesn't do anything. Enhancing the penalties, really, who's going to ask the victim their age before they commit the assault? I believe, in fact, that our whole criminal law system is based upon enhanced penalties for crimes of enhanced aggravation. Maybe that's not the way to go. But that's the theory of our law. It provides, we feel, some significant protection to the senior. It sends a clear message that seniors do have this physiological susceptibility to aggravated assault, and they're given special protection in the law. I would be happy to have pregnant women and hemophiliacs and those who are paraplegics and quadriplegic added to the bill, but we have to start somewhere. You can't put everything in every law. We try to do the best what we can, and the seniors throughout the state do feel this is something that they feel will give them some significant protection. It's something they want, and I'm certainly willing to push that for them. They came to me. I really decided not to offer this again this session, but on their own motion, they put this as one of their top priorities, and I do urge your consideration. Thank you. Glad to answer your questions.
Okay, are there any questions for Senator Brown? Representative Phillips.
Senator, I appreciate you bringing this before us. I do, almost out of curiosity more than anything else, the debate in the Senate, I noticed that Senator Jernstedt and Senator Roberts voted against this bill. Both those gentlemen, to my knowledge, are quite above the age of 65. Did they have a different perspective coming from that age than certainly I would?
Senator Jernstedt served on the Judiciary Committee at one time this bill was considered, and I think he didn't explain his vote, as I best recall, and it's hard for me to understand it. Maybe he just feels that it's a little bit of a conflict of interest for him to vote against it. The vote by Senator Roberts has been very clear. I think he feels that, at least based upon my knowledge of his feelings in earlier sessions, that this operates against the young black, the young the poor white, who basically quote makes his living at street mugging, and it operates kind of a discriminatory fashion against them. Another side of his Lincoln, I think, is that our jails are filled as it is, and this is just going to augment the prison overcrowding problem. And I think maybe at least that's Senator Roberts' thought, because I've heard him express it before in essentially those terms.
Another question.
This time he basically attacked it as cosmetic, and I don't feel it's cosmetic. I don't think the seniors feel it's cosmetic.
Well, if I may follow up.
Yes, Representative Phillips.
The prison overcrowding is obviously a problem that we've all talked about. Was there any discussion from anybody within the judicial branch or corrections as to how this might impact the...
In 1983, the prison overcrowding problem was addressed by the department, the head of the Division of Corrections, and basically his testimony would have a nominal effect on prison overcrowding. Now, I can't quite explain that rationale. I think it's because how the matrix system operates, which today takes into consideration the age of the victim and the nature of the injury. So you might say, well, this is handled much through the matrix system. But what we're trying here to do is not differentiate punishments, but to provide essentially an incentive, a motivation not to commit the crime in the first place. I see this as essentially making a substantial impact upon deterrence.
One further question.
Representative Phillips.
In Senate Judiciary, this may not be true, and correct me if it's not, but I believe the only individual over 65 is my senator, Senator Simmons.
Yes.
I don't know how he voted in Judiciary.
He sponsored the bill.
I know he's a sponsor of it, and obviously he voted for it on the floor, but this age of discrimination and drawing the limit of 65 versus 64 and a half, that didn't seem to cause anybody any real difficulty.
I think maybe he kind of up in a slightly quite dry humor, declared a conflict of interest. In fact, I had somebody call and ask how old I was, and I confessed that 58 and well under the age. And when we first started some years ago, I was in my early 50s. So I do think that Senator Simmons is supportive.
Well, I know he's supportive. I just wanted to know if there was any debate, because there's some statutes, especially housing division, 58 is considered to be a quote senior citizen. Not to pick on you, but that's the age that's used in statute. And I was just wondering, when you pick 65, I was driving down today and I heard a radio report saying senior citizens shouldn't be considered elderly until they get 75. So was there any discussion as to that date? Or
I think 65 was picked simply because that's the age that people in the old days became eligible for Social Security. For now, I think for getting a discount at King's Table or something is younger, but 65 seems the time when people take up golf and other strenuous activities and maybe try to come back trail. Maybe we should make it 75. We do have, as the economy goes down, an increase in timber theft, an increase in robberies, burglaries rather, an increase in street mugging. And there is a significant fear there. I'm sure Representative Miller and other of you who've gone door to door sense the fear of seniors when you come to those doors after the dark. My 27 years in the Navy was mostly spent working with physical and mental problems of disabled servicemen. And there's something called traumatic arthritis. And when people suffer violence, whether it's a car accident or a fall on the street, those joints that do suffer trauma quickly turn to aggravated arthritis. But in addition to that, there's a shock to the system that for many of these people kill them. And if they suffer a broken hip, they'll never do come back. They go to bed, and anywhere between half a year to a year, they're dead. And so it is a serious matter. Obviously, this is not the way, this is not the full solution. This is one half of 1% of the solution. We give young people jobs. We have education that is effective. We have an economy in the state that, you know, that gives opportunity. We try to avoid discrimination by reason of race and age in the workplace. Those are all the more positive ways of going, and I'm not happy with, you know, this approach, but it does have some ameliorative effect. I would wish we could do better, but I think it's part of a package of things. Years ago, I sponsored the bill that added $2 to the out-of-staters to come and visit our parks to create an Oregon Youth Corps where we would hire 500 kids and give them $1,000 a summer to patch up our state parks and clean and do a little bit of patrolling. That's now gone. If we keep the $2, we won't keep the kids. You know, I've raised three boys. I know how tough it is. They all live on the East Coast. I'm going back to Princeton tomorrow night to see one get married. I wish they lived in this state. They worked in the state. They don't. Other kids do stay here. They can't escape. There are no jobs. And this sort of street violence is the way they live. And we've got to let the message go out that don't pick on seniors, because they can't handle it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions for Senator Brown? Representative Kapinski.
Mr. Chair, I guess I have a question for you, but I'd like to clarify something on the record. I'm sure Senator Brown fully caught maybe what you said, but I think that black kids, young black youths beat up on black ladies, elderly ladies as well, more often than not it is to elderly black women than to white people. Also that it's young white youth beat up on blacks and whites, elderly people as well. I guess a question to you, former district attorney, assistant DA Springer. I was trying to figure out the definition of serious physical injury. Is Senator Brown, his hand is away from the gavel. In terms of application of like assault one, for if you assault, if I was assaulted and I fell by an Representative Miller did that to me, let's say, for example. And applied a certain amount of force. Yes.
Mr. McDonald?
Mark.
Mark? Come forward, please. I want you to listen to this question to see if you can assist me in responding.
You don't have to put the coat on just then.
You may want to take the coat off. Representative Kupeski, I'm sorry to interrupt, but Mark, I think, has been with DA and prosecution work more recently than I, and I think he's in a better position, perhaps, to respond to your question. If I'd like to start over.
If the same amount of force is used to push me, a 35-year-old individual, and I fall but don't break my hip, but am slightly injured, and the same amount of force is used by Representative Miller to shove this 67-year-old frail, pretty kind grandmother onto the sidewalk. This is the old law school examples that they used to do. But same amount of force, but as a result, she has her hip broken, let's say. And under our definitions of assault, a serious physical injury, I mean, doesn't it go to the individual and the eggshell?
Yes, you take the victim as you find them.
So I'm trying to understand here, generally, if we're talking about a senior citizen and they're assaulted, let's say, I mean, if the likelihood of that individual hurting their hip or having extended illness as a result of their age, bodily conditions, I mean, the likelihood is they're going to be charged with and maybe perhaps convicted of assault one. Would that be so? Or what's your experience?
I wouldn't say likely. I'd say it makes it more likely than not than somebody of a younger age. I wouldn't say likely because it's still very difficult to prove serious physical injury. There have been cases where people have been shot with guns and the bullet has passed through the person's body and their intestines have been damaged. Our other internal organs, and that has been considered not to be serious physical injury because that injury was able to be taken care of through operation or other medical treatment. So the definition of serious physical injury is very strict and limited. So if a person would happen, let's say an older person was pushed and fell down and broke their hip, if it could be treated medically so the person would return so they had the use of a limb or joint again, it would not be serious physical injury.
In your experience, Chair,
continue.
Representative Peterson could have shoved me down on that example also, in this nice grandmother type. Didn't want to pick just Representative Miller. Both would like to do that to me at certain times. And maybe at the same time. In your professional experience, have you seen a more difficult time in terms of convicting individuals that have assaulted seniors than assaulted somebody that's less than 60 years old?
No, I wouldn't say it's been more difficult.
Do you think it's been easier?
Well, definitely you've got a sympathy factor there if you take the case to the jury, and that's going to play on the jury's mind. So I guess in that respect, it might make it somewhat easier. But again, most cases are going to be determined upon their facts, what kind of witnesses you have and things of that sort.
Thank you. And a further question, in your experience here in Marion County, have you seen, it's been difficult for us to get any sort of statistics in terms of by crimes against age groups, and have you, in terms of your experience or professional, see that seniors are victims of crime more often in terms of actual physical abuse, let's say, as opposed to a burglary or crimes against the person?
That's very difficult to answer. I mean, I've seen several instances where they have been victims of crime for no apparent reason other than they were a person that was unable to defend themselves. Now, saying whether or not it's more, they're more often a victim than another distinguishable groups, that's very difficult to say. most of the assaults that we see are among people that know one another and usually involve alcohol or drugs. Domestic violence is the big, most common example.
You think if I'm walking down the street and somebody pulls a gun on me to rob me, that I should try to fight back and resist?
No.
Do you think a senior should?
No, I think anytime, you know, if it's a robbery type situation, I think the experts would tell you that it's much better to give up your money than try to resist and chance serious physical injury.
Regardless of your age.
Regardless of your age.
Okay, thank you very much. That's been very helpful.
Okay, are there any further questions for either the witnesses or additional comments?
Mr. Chairman, concerning my observation about Senator Roberts' rationale concerning the black culprit, I do concur with what Representative Kubeski said, really the most susceptible victim in society turns out to be the young black juvenile, 18, 19, 20, the most victimized group in society are really the people who have least to put up in the way of money or they're victimized in all ways, including violent crime. So I'm just trying to verbalize in my not too skillful way how Senator Roberts racialized those discussions with me over the last couple of years.
Okay.
Thank
you. Representative Miller.
Senator, given, I think you said that the increased penalty here would act as a deterrent.
Yes.
Is it fair to assume you also support the death penalty?
I do not support the death penalty as a matter of religious scruples. I have appeared in churches in Lake Oswego through the years and publicly taken a stand against the death penalty. I don't support abortion. I don't support sending military aid to the Contras. And Representative Miller. The other day, I kind of carried the day in the Senate Judiciary Committee to increase the minimum maximum for first-degree murder from 10 to 15 years over the opposition chairman. We won the day 5-4 on my motion to increase the minimum maximum. So that's my opposition to capital punishment is based upon a biblical injunction about killing.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Senator Brown, I think last time when you were here, you weren't able to stay long, and I directed most of my questions to the speaker who came after. I do have some serious reservations about special protection under the law. I think I'm from a group that in the past 25 years has made headway in terms of equal in the world, and so it's a little hard for me to deal with the idea of some kind of special protection for any group. I guess one of the questions I wanted to ask was, I think you mentioned earlier that several states have considered this kind of legislation. Have any states actually passed this kind of legislation?
In fact, I haven't brought that amateur citation up, but just the case aside of the American jurisprudence under age would be an example.
I guess I'm referring, if I may, Mr. Chair, to just the kind of legislation you have introduced in terms of stronger deterrence for people who abuse seniors. Have any states passed that sort of legislation?
My understanding is yes, but I don't have a citation right.
You don't know how many states or which ones?
No, but there's constantly been a push in that direction. I do believe that Massachusetts has. I believe New York has, and
well, if that information is in the material you handed out, I'm sure I can find it.
No, but it's, I'm not sure. No, this material was called 2 or 4 years ago. And the proposal for this type of legislation had its origin in 1980, because there was a lot of pressure in 1980. You notice this convention, this conference in Massachusetts was in late 1980. The source book of legislation was in 1980, and most of this legislation has been in the last 4 years has been discussed. Now, I'd be glad to try to run that down.
I'd appreciate that. That would be helpful.
I think the important point to make is that age and sex have been used as statutory means for aggravation. We're having the problem right now, you know, with juvenile pornography, and it's an age-based statute.
If I may continue, I think we do that sometimes because children until they're 18 are not really, as I understand the law, are not really considered adults in a variety of ways where anyone over 18 is. But I would appreciate it if you could find out.
I'll see if I can go to Amjur and trace that down and see if there's been any. We don't have a handy mechanism for finding those statutes without sitting down and going to 50.
I would suspect some of the senior groups might be able to pull
that. They're even less able than a lawyer is to find those. Mm-hmm. But I'll give it a college try.
Thank you.
It's abhorrent to one's sense of decency and justice that a criminal may receive large sums of money while other people are dead or injured as a result of the criminal's conduct. This bill makes it clear that in this instance, the victim is more important than the criminal. At a time in which it's becoming commonplace for convicted felons to make monetary gains by selling the rights of their story, many states have adopted legislation which affects these actions. Such statutes, first enacted in New York in 1977, have now been adopted by 18 states. In addition, the federal government has adopted such a statute, the Victims of Crime Act of 1984, and is encouraging further adoption by states. Such laws are commonly referred to as Son of Sam laws as a result of the Son of Sam criminal murders in 1977 in New York. David Berkowitz, the so-called Son of Sam, later sold his story to McGraw-Hill for an undisclosed sum. Generally, most state Son of Sam laws have language similar to New York's. Under these laws, including 3030, the government acts as an escrow agent, usually under a 5-year escrow account. The criminal retains legal title to the funds until they are paid out to the victim or creditors. If the victim is unsuccessful in obtaining money judgments, or if the criminal charges are dismissed, the government is required to pay immediately the escrow funds to the formerly accused criminal. In examining the proposed bill, it is important to establish what purposes it does not seek to achieve. House Bill 303-30 is not intended to and will not have the effect of deterring a criminal from telling the circumstances surrounding the commission of the crime or to tell her thoughts or feelings about a crime. Also, the proposed bill does not attempt to compensate victims in general. The victim is allowed to raise his or her claim to the escrow account through an equitable right to them as the victim of the crime which generated those funds. In this way, the bill is concerned with the special nature of the funds being attached. The purpose of the bill is to ensure liability from the profits which the offender indirectly receives from the crime. Questions have been raised regarding the impact of the Son of Sam statute on free speech rights. A full analysis of the impact of the statutes on First Amendment rights is a multi-step process. I'm not going to read the entire document. I will take excerpts from this point forward and leave the rest of the document for your reference. In determining the First Amendment considerations, first, it is necessary to determine whether the literary works involved in the statutes are subject to the First Amendment protection. They are. Second, if the works are protected, and they are, consideration must be given to whether the statutes deter the offender from exercising his rights to produce them. The statutes do not deter the offender from producing the literary works. Even if deterrence occurs, the manner in which deterrence operates raises constitutional questions. In addition, the possibility that the publisher is being deterred from informing the public regarding the offender's views must be analyzed. Finally, even if the statute does interfere with the offender telling his story to some degree, such interference may be constitutional under the O'Brien test if the restrictions are not content-based and the statute's purpose is not solely to prevent the offender from telling his story. The restrictions are not content-based and the purpose of the statute is not to prevent the offender from telling his or her story. Therefore, Son of Sam statutes pass the O'Brien test. There's further examination of the O'Brien test and the court's decision that established the O'Brien test in the body of the document before you. I'd like to turn now to page, my copy is numbered, but I believe it's around page 8, to the subheading due process. In addition to considerations of free speech rights, and those considerations must be taken into account in any Son of Sam law, there are considerations of procedural due process. Procedural due process constitutes the other major area of constitutional concern regarding the proposed statute. Due process is implicated because the funds are held to the benefit of victims of the offender without any preliminary determination, before or after the funds are attached, that there are victims with sufficient claims to justify holding the funds. Due process of law requires that a meaningful opportunity to be heard, appropriate to the nature of the case, must precede any final deprivation of an individual's property. In the case of the proposed statute, such an opportunity is provided by the requirement that any payment out of the escrow account to a victim or to an attorney, or to the dependent of the victim, must be pursuant to a judgment of a court of competent jurisdiction. However, in addition to a hearing before the final deprivation of property, a hearing must be given before any temporary, non-final deprivation, or in extraordinary circumstances, a hearing may be held immediately following the commencement of the deprivation. The Supreme Court, in a case called Sniadoc versus Family Finance, first established this rule by holding Wisconsin prejudgment garnishment procedures invalid because they denied the employee debtor an opportunity to be heard before the seizure of her wages. Jumping to the next page, although the state will be allowed to delay the necessary hearing required by the court's decision in that case until after the payment of the funds into the escrow account, it must provide one at that time. The Department of Justice would have to have a hearing at that time. The requirements of such a hearing have not been delineated specifically by the court, except that it must provide a, quote, real test, unquote, consistent with the goal of preventing unfair and mistaken deprivations of property by establishing the validity, or at least the probable validity, of the underlying claim. In this case, due process would require a hearing immediately after the establishment of the escrow account to determine that there are likely to be claimants, either dependents of victims or victims, to the funds in the account, and that those claims are likely to encompass all of the money which has been seized. If the offender has been convicted of the offense, this determination will be relatively simple, since it could be based upon the findings of the criminal case. A simpler solution would be to provide an immediate post-seizure hearing to determine the validity of the deprivation based extensively upon the record of the criminal case. An important balance must be maintained between the First Amendment rights of offenders and equitable notions that a person should not be allowed to profit as a result of his own wrongdoing. The offender may provide a valuable primary source of information on many subjects of public concern, such as crime prevention and capital punishment. The provision of material incentives for the offender to sell his story, which is delineated in the document, as provided by the proposed statute, fulfills both the goals of encouraging dissemination of information and providing restitution to the victims. The adoption of a statute based on the New York model fulfills equitable needs which might go unmet and does not violate the public's right to know or the offender's right to speak. The statute, however, must not extend beyond these narrow goals. The statute only should attach funds necessary to compensate victims. A preliminary hearing immediately following the attachment could protect against excessive attachment and satisfy due process. The statute should not become a tool for the punishment of the offender. Such a statute would be unfair and might not meet the constitutional test. not only because it is limited to those offenders who sell their stories, but also because it is likely to actually deter the offender from ever selling his story. Such a statute would block an important channel of communication in violation of the First Amendment and effectively would eliminate funds to compensate the victim. If the statute is used for punitive purposes, neither the offender nor society nor the victim is benefited. It may offend the sensibilities of many individuals to allow government to intervene as deeply into the arena of protected communications as does the proposed statute. However, it is more offensive to allow perpetrators of crimes of violence to profit from their crimes while their victims go uncompensated. The proposed statute shows it is possible for the equitable rights of the victim to be advanced while safeguarding the constitutional rights of the offender. This testimony is taken in large part from a journal from a story in the Northwestern University School of Law, Journal of Criminal Law and Criminology, number 3, fall 1980. I do have that full article for the committee's reference. The summary of that article, which I presented here, goes into more detail as to why the First Amendment test is met. And I wish I could read the whole thing, but it'd take about 45 minutes. You probably don't want to listen to it at this point. In summary, 18 states have such statutes. None have been found unconstitutional. The federal government recently adopted such a statute. The statutes vary from state to state in some points. Basically, they follow the same form. Criminal is accused or convicted. If the accused or convicted criminal sells a story, then the person making the contract with the criminal must place the payment according to the contract the criminal would receive or the accused person would receive with the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice will maintain that money intact in an escrow account. If there is a criminal, or if a court of competent jurisdiction finds in favor of a victim, then the money may be attached, and only then. To meet the due process clause, when the money is placed in the escrow account, there would need to be a hearing by the Department of Justice to show that there is probable cause that there are victims to be compensated or dependents of victims to be compensated. So far, none of these laws have been thrown out of court. I'm bringing this to you because of information I learned from the paper, and there are several articles in the packet before you that Elizabeth Diane Downs, who's convicted murderess, has made a contract to sell her story for an undisclosed sum. There is no guarantee that money will go to benefit her victims. Suits can be filed by the guardians of the victims. They're her children, her two surviving children. There's no guarantee that she will have that money when the judgment is given by the court of competent jurisdiction. By putting the money in the escrow account, the criminal would actually still retain title to the money, but it would be in safekeeping for 5 years. At the end of 5 years, according to the bill and other similar statutes, if there are no claims within 5 years, the money would revert to the criminal. That satisfies the due process, and it's not an extreme deprivation. It's susceptible under the O'Brien test. If the person is accused and acquitted, or the conviction is overturned, they receive the money too. So those are the conditions of the bill of section 3 and 4. The other section of the bill, section 1 and 2, is a little bit different, which was, it's an issue I wanted to address. I took the advantage to place it in this bill. It would create an additional aggravated form of felonies for those felonies that are committed against a person 16 years or younger, and which felony does not already have age as a material element. In other words, I've included a copy of chapter 163 index with your packet. If you look at that, the check marks under homicide, assault, kidnapping, and related offenses, and coercion, the check marks indicate felonies in which this would apply, which age is not a material factor. Under sexual offenses and offenses against family, the circled numbers indicate felonies in which age is already a material aspect of the crime. And the number indicates the age is given in the statute. In other words, most sexual offenses have age as a material element of what the person is accused of. Incapacity to consent applies when an act occurs with someone under 18. A sodomy in the second degree, someone has to be under 14. The victim must be under 14. And so on through the sexual offenses. Kidnapping has no such material element. There's no age element in kidnapping. What we have is we have precedent that age is important in personal assault cases. We've determined over the years it's an important element. In other words, it's worthy of creating a stiffer penalty for a crime convicted against a young person than against an adult. But what I'm doing here is suggesting that we extend the same aggravated form of offense to assault, kidnapping, homicide, coercion, custodial interference, criminal mistreatment, manslaughter. I believe that covers all of them. Those personal assault crimes against a child are a more serious offense than those crimes against an adult. And that's the purpose of the first two sections.
Quick question.
If your first two sections of the bill involve a fiscal impact requiring the bill to go to Ways and Means, would you prefer we delete those sections from the bill and use a different vehicle if the
votes? Yes.
Thank you.
I only have one priority. Representative Hill, will you be able to join us after the recess?
Yeah.
Respond to questions?
Okay.
Also, we'll have some amendments I'll need to explain.
Okay, we'll be in recess. Hopefully, no. House Judiciary Committee, Subcommittee 1, will come back to order, please. We have three members sufficient for a hearing, not sufficient for a work session, but Representative Hill, I know that there were some questions, perhaps, or you had some. I think you wanted to speak as well to the amendments which you have.
Yeah,
so if you'd like to go ahead and proceed, we'd be glad to hear from you now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendments, I'm introducing these amendments, these are mine, based upon a discussion with the District Attorneys Association. I talked with, Mr. Carter, I believe, and he made these recommendations. What they do are three things. They add guilty except for insanity to make sure that it's understood that that is included in the covered compensable crimes. If someone is convicted of murder except for insanity, then they would, and they sold their story, they would be covered, and this is just to make clear that they would be covered. Secondly, sub 8, line 14 on the amendments, provides that if there's multiple victims, we run the danger of the first one getting a judgment, draining the whole escrow account, and the other victims who may have an equal or superior claim not having anything. So we're following the example here of several states who are prorating out the monies that would be placed in the account among the victims. And section 6 at the bottom provides that the statute of limitations, which normally runs for 2 years following the injury, would run for 5. Now, the statute of limitations issue is a little complicated, so allow me to explore it with you. Currently, the statute of limitations for filing suit for an injury in an armed robbery, if you're shot and injured, you can file suit for 2 years. That's all. That's your statute of limitations. This would extend that to 5 years in the case of compensable crimes. Also, in addition, if this were adopted, in addition, the bill itself provides that when the contract is made, and the publication of the experience of the criminal is made, there would be a 5-year period, which would effectively be a continuation of the statute of limitations. This could occur 7 years after the crime, or 8 years after the crime, or 9 years after the crime. And then, if the criminal sold their story, it would begin, and there'd be a 5-year window. So that would be the effect of the escrow account and the content of the bill. This would be a further establishment of a 5-year statute of limitations window. immediately following the crime.
Representative Miller.
Representative Hill, this individual who might be attempting to make some money on this, as I understand it, what they have to write about, or the movie has to be about their criminal activity. So if this person who became famous for some unusual crime decided to write poetry that was unrelated somewhat, other than show if they were slightly detached or something, they can go ahead and sell all the poetry they'd like if it didn't relate to the crime.
Let's go through the section, and it'll illustrate the answers to your question, which is an excellent question. Section 4, sub 1, provides that when any person contracts with an individual charged with or convicted of committing a compensable crime. So the first test is it must be a compensable crime. And that's already defined in the statutes. That is, it must have injured someone in this state, or with the representative of that criminal, or the person charged with that crime, for payment of money in return for the right to reenact such crime or to describe the individual's thoughts, opinions, or emotions regarding the crime in a motion picture, book, magazine, article, tape, recording, phonograph, record, radio, or television presentation, or live entertainment, which would include poetry, if it's about the crime, for profit. Then that person, say McGraw-Hill or Oregon Magazine, would promptly submit a copy of the contract to the Department of Justice and pay to the department any monies which would otherwise, under the terms of the contract, go to the criminal. So Oregon Magazine contracts with Elizabeth Diane Downs for poetry about her crime. Then Oregon Magazine must pay that money to the Department of Justice. Now, if Elizabeth Diane Downs writes poetry about fluffy bunnies, it doesn't come under this provision. Only about her crime.
Representative Miller, question.
I guess who makes the determination as to whether or not the expressions of the poetry or whatever relates to the crime? Suppose Diane Downs decides to write about how nice it is to take a drive between Springfield and Eugene on some highway that may have been important for the crime, but just describes what a nice thing it is to drive out there. Some kind of, I don't know how it'd be written, but something that would give you the indication that she was thinking about this event, but really doesn't describe that she turned around and did what she apparently did.
Representative, it must be specific. It must be specific.
According to whom, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at.
The statute is specific, and the department would make rules interpreting the statute. So it would be the department elaborating on statute. The statute would state for the right to reenact, so if they purchase the right to reenact the crime, or to describe the individual thoughts, opinions, or emotions regarding the crime. So it must be something specific to the crime. If it's just about driving that highway, it might bring thoughts about the crime. That would not be specific enough. It must be specific to the crime. It must mention the person.
Further questions, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Miller.
If you had some of the folks over at the Penn decided to get together and put together a book right now detailing their criminal activities and decided to sell it over at the Penn store, their monies would be, or whatever profits they'd make under that arrangement, would be affected by this bill.
If they made a contract with McGraw-Hill to publish their book, if Joe Smith is convicted of a compensable crime, in a crime in which there are victims, then if Joe Smith writes about the crime in that book and contracts with the publisher to print the book or sells the story, that would fall under the provisions of the statute. It doesn't have to be a crime of murder. On the second page of the bill, there's existing language defining compensable crime. on lines 31, 32, and 33. And that's an intentional, knowing, or reckless act that results in serious bodily injury or death of another person, and which, if committed by a person of full legal capacity, would be punishable as a crime of the state. That's existing law. And that was put into law to pertain to the crime victims' compensation programs. That's the definition currently used. By having the conviction of a crime, the conviction, the facts brought out in the trial, that would describe clearly, it would provide the evidence for the Department of Justice to determine if this is a compensable crime. The Department of Justice would need to determine that this indeed is a compensable crime, falls under the statute. And I mentioned earlier, due process would be satisfied by a simple determination that the facts of the case brought forward in the trial, that could justify the findings that it is a compensable crime and this would apply. In addition to that, the Department of Justice, when money comes into the account under the statute, would need to have at least a pro forma hearing that there are victims of the crime who might be able to obtain judgments. There's reasonable cause to think that there are victims who could benefit from the money's put in the escrow account. That would satisfy due process.
Representative Miller. Just so I can get a handle on what the Department of Justice may be asked to do here. I may be wrong on the person in the famous crimes in Oregon, but I think it was Jerome Henry Brudos had a desire to do a lot of chopping. I think that was his technique. What if he decided to produce a book suitable for butchers or something on the art of chopping up humans, but made no specific reference to the particular humans that he chopped?
If he spoke about chopping up other humans.
Well, just spoke about that kind of crime in general terms. Are the rights to that publication going to be held, or the proceeds held in escrow?
No. The purpose of the book is not to deter this gentleman, Henry Brudos, whomever, from writing about chopping up people. The purpose is to attach profits gained from a particular crime to benefit the victims of that crime. So if we have someone who's a multiple criminal, who steals cars and shoots people, if he or she writes about stealing cars, this would not apply, because it's not a statute to punish, it's a statute to provide restitution and compensation if the victim obtains that through a court of competent jurisdiction. That's important to determine. It would be unconstitutional to simply deprive criminals of all profits from all writings, and it would be unconstitutional to categorically deprive them of all writings about all their crimes. It's only constitutional if it's specific to the crime and the purpose is to put the profits to the benefit of the victims of that crime. So it must be specific.
If I can have one more now.
That's fine. First thing out.
In the Brudos example, if in writing about the techniques of chopping, he mentions one of the chopped choppies. Is that, is he into this situation then, where he is described his emotions or thoughts about regarding the crime? I mean, is that portion of the book somehow? We're going to portion some of the proceeds of the sale of that book?
If the book mentions the crime, it would fall under the statute.
The whole book, even though
because the
book in its entirety really dealt with that crime very little.
If the book has 15 chapters and one chapter talks about the crime, the profits gained from the book would fall within the purview of this statute. He could excerpt that chapter.
Or he could chop it out, probably.
He could chop it up. The Department of Justice would have to be sharp to catch that.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Large
I promise that'd be the end.
Okay. Council?
Representative Hill, I just have a couple of questions for you. In trying to visualize how this would work, I think you've laid it out beautifully and it makes a lot of sense. The only thing that I didn't, maybe I missed it because I was out of the room, didn't hear, was you created a civil right of action for the victim for compensation for the damage done to them during the crime. Is that correct?
No.
No. All right.
We're creating no new right of action. We're only, the only right of action that would exist under this bill is right of action that exists currently. We do extend the statute of limitations with the original bill, and that extension would occur at the point the criminal makes a profit until 5 years following that, that point. And during that period, the bill would have the Department of Justice attempting to notify the victims there is cash available if they institute a right of action under other statutes and existing rights of action.
The question I would ask you is, what other right of action does a victim have? In your opinion, I mean.
Oh, what existing right of action?
Because I wasn't clear when I was reading whether you were talking about the restitution that a judge orders to a victim, say when the defendant is sentenced, or whether you're talking about a civil right of action for damages.
Both.
You're talking about both. So you're really talking about general civil right of action for damages that may exist for a victim on the civil side of things.
Yes. Any right of action that a victim may currently have springing from the damages they suffered in that crime. Any judgment, whether it's restitution or whether it's a civil judgment through an independent civil case that they filed, either at that time or later within the statute of limitations, any judgment could attach the funds in this escrow account. That's the way it is in most of the other states, although we're creating no new right of action.
Representative Hill, this important discussion we're having, I know there are more questions. I have some. I know Representative Kavetsky has some. I have a message from the speaker that says that Representative Larry Hill is required on the floor now.
Okay, now is underlined.
Now is underlined. So I think
now is,
you're excused for that purpose. if you wish to come back
to
Representative later this afternoon or early evening, whichever it's going to be, and rejoin us, you're welcome. If you're unable to, and we will hope to carry this, continue this tomorrow, as we hope to with the rest of the bills we don't get to today.
Okay?
Thank you. I want to take up a couple Senate bills because we've had people unfortunately waiting here most of the afternoon, and it's their second afternoon with us, which we're certainly glad to have them here, but I know that they have other things to do as well. So I'd like to take up 148, and then we'll move to 451 and the rest of the Senate bills we have before us.
Sorry, 148.
148. Council?